get started. And what we can do, I'll give just a brief introduction to these sayings. And then we can read them together. And feel free to interact with them, with me, ponder, question, whatever seems to be going on. They were, again, these things that we'll be seeing occurred in this context. Particularly in Egyptian monasticism, you have a movement out into the desert at the beginning with folks that we would call hermits, and then gradually the hermits became communities guided and directed by an Abba. Later on, women were gathered together in communities under the leadership of women such as Sarah Simplenike and others. And, for example, in Western Asceticism, in Chadwick's book, both Amma Sarah and Amma Simplenike appear often. And then the saying, in some ways, I don't want to overgeneralize, but what would happen would be an Abba would be praying as the day went on, praying on psalms, working manually, praying for discernment, and sometimes a word would come. A word would come. And then amongst the communities, as the different leaders of these communities became well known, words would be exchanged. Or folks who had been apart for most of the week would come together on a Saturday or a Sunday and exchange what had occurred, what had occurred, happened somewhere else, a word that was given to somebody else. So what we're doing this afternoon is taking a look at how Chadwick has broken this material down. First of all, I thought we could start with a word from Amma Simplenike. Now, as you're taking a look at this, I'm going to read these slowly. As you're taking a look at this word, think in terms of the scaffolding, the underpinning that we worked through this morning. That underpinning is a part of her being. It's just a part of the rhyme and reason of her life and of particularly her mind. In her thinking and in thinking of these other folks, one of the goals is to have a mind that's increasingly conformed to the mind of Christ. She want to read the world like Christ did. Make sense? They want to read the world as he did. So this integration, as you can see it here, the integration of mind, they might say mind and heart, mind and behavior. They won't use this kind of language, but mind and affections, and then the will, so on. Augustine will talk about it. Is at the heart of what this is about. So it's a good way, I think, to move directly into primary source of material, if I can put it that way. So, quote, it's dangerous for a man to try teaching before he's trained in the good life. I'm hoping that verb will jump right off at you. The training involved. These folks, for instance, would feel uncomfortable about a young teacher teaching in a group. That would make them feel comfortable because they wonder, well, has she had time for the regiment, the discipline? And then later on, she'll warn about older folks who are teaching, and others will, who have not entered into the regiment, and it's a disaster. So we have the idea of training in the good life. So a good life would be identifiable. They would say, if you want to see a good life, deeply human life, look at look at Christ and others in our communities who are increasingly becoming like him, enter into the discipline. And then something I think that we can identify with here, someone whose house is about to fall down, they invite travelers inside to refresh them. So the traveler thinks something's going to be offered to them. A meal, perhaps. Respite, perhaps. Rest. But instead they're hurt in the collapse of the house. And it's in the plural, not the singular. Not only is the person who wanted to do the teaching hurt, perhaps destroyed, but those that they have invited in and asked to dwell with them are destroyed. She says it's the same with teachers who have not carefully, she said it again, training themselves in the good life. So it happens twice. Isn't that striking? She says the same thing twice. So I'm looking at you and I'm wondering, how could we go about, is there almost a curriculum that could be developed for helping we as pastors and so on within the church to help people learn how to live in a way that enters into goodness itself? Goodness by definition being Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What would the regimen look like? If not, hearers as well as teachers are destroyed. The teacher's destroyed because of this disjunction between word and deed. And the hearers are destroyed because they've been taught by somebody who's untrained. Their mouth invites to salvation. Their way of life leads to ruin. So there's she's deeply concerned about a lack of integration. Someone who might be a gifted speaker does very well with words, but if you got to know that person really well, the life doesn't match up with the teaching. So the call here in desert spirituality is integration. Integration. A life lived well before God. A life that rings true. So that Jim Houston once said this to me, so that the currency of our words matches up with the gold of our life, if we were still on the gold standard. A life that rings true, and by definition again, for these folks, a life that rings true is a life that's fulfilled with love. A love that can be astringent at times, but sometimes amazingly gentle. And so I think we'll see here in a little bit. So I thought that's a good one to start with.
Chris, would you say that, make that point again about the currency of our life?
Let me see if I get this right. This is Jim Houston, James Houston at Regent College. And he said, the call is a life lived in such a way that the gold of our life matches the currency of our words. So I got a $5 bill in my back pocket. Currency. Is there gold to back it up? And none of us do this perfectly, and they would understand this. But one of the things that's been disturbing to me, for example, I work with, I know Joanna, David Neff, Christianity Today, that magazine. In almost every issue of that magazine, there's a story of somebody whose life has imploded. Well-known leader, and generally speaking, it has to do with three issues, all of which they will address in some way. The big three kind of sums up everything would be money and issues related to money, sex and issues related to sexual behavior, and power. Those are the three big ones. And the issue of shame and sin. You could almost group everything under there somewhere. So within the church, within the evangelical wing of the church, surely there's work to be done. But what's encouraging, my students have found encouraging, is to be told, you can actually learn how to do this. It's not simply a passive activity. You can learn how to love somebody. You can learn how to live a chaste life before God. It's possible. And I'm telling you, when I start talking about chastity, they are deeply attracted to that word. They long for chastity. But they know they most don't have it. In fact, you could hear a pin drop. And I'll look around at the room and people will be looking down. Nobody wants to look me in the face, that kind of thing. Bless every one of them. So the idea that it's something that can be learned is good.
One quick, will you please pronounce her name again?
Well, the way I say it is Sinclair. But I say my C's in Greek like their heart. Some people might say Sue's, I don't know. I'm so used to saying them. How else could you say it? Something like that. Sinclair. So now we have so with the scaffolding we built this morning, here's some of what they'll say about quiet. So we're going to move into a learning space. The issue of passions, the issue of distractions, all that stuff is now the issues that they're going to be addressing in their own inimitable fashion out there in the desert. Now, what I've got here, just so you know, when I say part 2 to page 40, I'm referring to Chadwick. So if you get the book, you'll know from the PowerPoint where to find the saying in the book. And what I've done is just got into Chadwick and called out some saying that I thought you might find of interest. So this is, I think, one of the most important ones regarding quiet. He also said, the man who abides in solitude and is quiet is delivered from fighting 3 battles. Those of hearing, speech, and sight. Then he will have but one battle to fight, the battle of the heart. So you don't get delivered from struggle. But there are 3 specific battles that are very interesting. Those of hearing, speech, and sight. So I'm going to take a moment on this. A book that really has helped me. I read it in the late 70s, couldn't make any sense out of it. That was Celebration of Discipline, Foster's book. He just couldn't make any sense out of it. I didn't know what he was talking about. And then I got back to it in the 80s, and it started kind of clicked. And in the chapter on meditation, it begins, quote, our adversary, the devil, majors in 3 things. Noise, hurry, and crowds. And I thought, later on, I thought, oh my goodness gracious, it sounds like an awe. Our adversary, the devil, majors in 3 things. So these things are, in the Christian tradition, can be demonic. And Foster says, noise, hurry, and crowds. Out of all the things that he could have focused on, or hear hearing, speech, sight. And you see the similarity, noise, hurries, crowds. And then he goes on and speaks in a Quaker fashion. He says, if he, that is our adversary, the devil, if he can keep us engaged in muchness and manyness, he will rest satisfied. And there are stories in the desert literature, and they're kind of wild and crazy, but there's a story, for example, of a monk who's working really hard at manual labor. And he's got a mallet out, and he's whacking rocks. He's working terribly hard, and standing next to him is a demon encouraging him on at the work, applauding the hard work. But from their perspective, it's not praiseworthy. Jeez, in workaholism and all those associated issues. Hearing, speech,
Sorry. So let me try to give you an example of how this might look in a human life for somebody who's in their 60s, who was once in his 20s. It seems so long ago. So I'm at UCLA making this transition. This has specifically to do with hearing. And before I made the transition into the kingdom, one of my heroes, who I guess I would have to call an anti-hero now, bless his heart, but one of my heroes was Jim Morrison. Oh, I know every Doors song. Even pull a string. I mean, I know everyone. Why? Because I listened and listened and listened and listened, and there was something in that music that I was deeply attracted to. You know, he went to seminary and later rejected it. He had a memory like a camera. He'd invite somebody into his home. There'd be all these books on the shelf. And he'd say, choose a book. And they'd say, choose a page number. They'd open it up and he'd start reciting what was on that page. And he died when he was 27, 28. But that music, so I'm making a transition now into, during a desert time, I'm making a transition into the kingdom of God. And I realized, because I'm still listening to the Doors amongst others, especially to the Doors. In fact, you know, their name, the Doors, is related to the phrase, Doors of Perception. That's where he got that phrase from. Might have been from Herman Hesse. Anyway, Doors of Perception. I'm listening to Doors, and then I discovered, every time I'm listening to him, I start thinking about women in a way that's not all that great. What's that about? I start thinking about violence in a way that's not so great. And I realized that in my life and the way I was wired, there were going to have to be certain no's if I was going to move to a new place. And I'm not saying to you that you shouldn't listen to Jim Morrison. I'm not going to do that. You might be wired differently from me. I think the music itself is pretty good. And I'm not going to lie to you. If the Doors come on the radio and I'm driving down the highway, I'm not turning it off. I am unable to do so. If I had an Abba next to me, he might say, turn it off. I say, all right. But left to myself. But see, that has to do with hearing. And they didn't understand that the voices we listen to affect us deeply. Now, I gave an example from music, but there's also lyrics involved. But we can all, I think, ask at this point, I think I did this morning, how has what I've heard formed and shaped me? And it can bring life or it can bring death. Some of us, speech, I am sure of two things, and I think these folks would agree. We remember when people have used speech to harm us, do we not? We can remember. It might have been something a parent said, something a child said, a bully, something a high school teacher said, something a college professor said. We remember hurtful words. And so they would work with somebody who remembers hurtful words. We also remember, don't you, the times when someone said something and it's made your heart sing. Someone's in an appropriate way said, that's great work, or that's wonderful gifting, or something a parent said, just thought because you're somebody's son or somebody's daughter, I'm just proud of you. And we breathe in those words like air. So they were very aware of the importance of words and how words are used. And how words can harm. I think that we'll see that this afternoon. And then sight, what we've seen. So the great battle for them, the great battle for Christians in the early church, sometimes had to do with sight. I'll give you two specific examples. One, violence.
So you'll find, for example, Augustine coaching a close friend who's continually tempted after his conversion, still to head off to the circus, head off to the local Colosseum, and to watch the gladiators. For example, gladiators are like American football players, but to a more extreme degree. They were the superstars. They were the celebrities. They lost their citizenship if they became a gladiator. So there's the Roman government accepted it. It's self-recognized about this kind of activity. But they were very popular. And he had a friend. And he helped him stop looking at something that Augustine felt was going to really harm him if he kept it up. So it's a very sweet exchange. So that was one area. And the second area had to do with issues of human sexuality. So pornography was very popular in the Roman Empire. On street corners, statuary, walking into a Roman villa. I would keep giving you, but I ran across some of this stuff. And I put it on slides to make a point one day in a presentation. I don't think I'm going to do it again. But it just helped people understand, the world of the internet is not the first time that human beings have struggled with this. So to walk into the villa of a wealthy Roman, you might well walk past a pornographic statuary. In inns, you'd find pornography on the walls of the inns where people would stay at night, and people knew what to expect and were hoping to see when they would walk into an inn on the road. It's one of the reasons why Christians would try to find other Christians to stay with, because they weren't healthy places. So I think that these are the three battles that continue to be the struggle for folks within the church. And surely they are the battle of the students that I deal with from between, say, ages 22 and 20, excuse me, between ages 18 and 24. Again, the minute I start talking about these issues, you could hear a pin drop. But they don't leave us with the problem, they take us to the solution. And when I say to a kid, we can move beyond this, you can see an expression change. It's been so troubling.
Excuse me, who was the he?
Let me look.
It's Anthony.
Page 40. I can't remember off the top of my head.
It's Anthony.
Is it Anthony, really?
Yeah. Pretty sure.
What I got here? Part 2. Number 2. Yeah, it's Anthony.
Good.
Anthony, or sometimes known as Anthony the Great, you think he'd just be an old grizzly bear. He has this real gentle side to him that we'll see a little bit later, too. This is a fairly robust saying, but there's a gentle side to him. Anytime you want to comment, ponder, question, let me know. This is Abinadab. So the arrows of the enemy cannot touch him who loves quiet. But he who moves in a crowd will be often wounded. Here's a perfect example of how weird these things are, because you look at that and you go, huh? What? What does that mean? So what do you think it means? Any ideas? What do you think that means?
Well, there's chaos in crowd.
So there's chaos in a crowd. What is it?
Lots and lots of distraction and multiple input of...
So, that's good. Distraction, multiple input. Can you think of a Pauline text that might match up with something like what Abinadab is saying here? Because their minds are like a biblical Rolodex, and they've always got the scripture in the back of their mind. Anything that comes to mind?
Maybe a party spirit.
Excuse me?
A party spirit.
I hadn't thought of that. Party spirit. Anything else that comes to mind about the kind of the molding and shaping effect?
don't be conformed to the world, but be transformed by the renewing of.
Yeah, that was the one that was coming to mind for me. J.B. Phillips translates that. Don't let the world squeeze you. Go ahead.
Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold.
Right. Don't let the world squeeze you into its mold. Be renewed. Your mind. So there's a kind of cultural consensus. There's a historian named Richard Lovelace. Maybe you've read him. Dynamics of Spiritual Renewal, I think, was the name of the book, a big book from IVP. He talks about the world as corporate flesh. So let's just think about our fallenness and sin for a minute. That's a happy topic. So we each one of us have our own history, if we can put it that way, and our own skewed tendencies, and so on. We're individually capable of significant evil. Well, you add it all up. You add it all up, and the sum that we end up with is greater than the mathematics would think. You think, all right, we've got 40 people in here, add it all up, it'll add up to 80, rather than 40 in terms of the effect of what he calls corporate flesh. So these folks are very aware of this, and they feel that if we can get somebody in a space that's quiet enough, at least part of the dynamic is things will begin to bubble to the surface that they can begin to deal with. But it takes great skill and sensitivity and discernment, gentleness, all kinds of things. Yeah.
What does this say about contemporary worship?
Which one?
The second one. Moving in crowds, loving quiet.
I don't know. That's where you could help me. I'm not terribly familiar with that, with contemporary worship. What were you thinking?
Well, I know that at least in my tradition, the push is large churches. Just do whatever to get the crowds. And most of worship, most of it is just noise. Lots and lots and lots of noise. Overpowered with noise. The adrenaline.
Oh, the adrenaline.
More performance, stage performance. I find it terribly.
Well, they would feel uncomfortable with the idea of worship as entertainment. That would trouble them. That'd trouble him. They would, they'd be watching how people are using their bodies. That they would be sensitive to those issues. They would feel uncomfortable walking into a context for worship, and where certain symbols were not present. They'd be walking into a place that looked like a theater would probably make them feel uncomfortable because they had very strong ideas about the theater. And in the ancient church, an actor would not be baptized. You had to leave the location behind them somewhere. So maybe some of those things would come about. Setting in the atmosphere.
Because if you have music pounding in your ears, with, like you said, as entertainment, it's very hard to get inside your own mind when it's music being thrust at you. So.
To say positively for a minute, that just comes to mind. I have a friend, Harry Thomas. I don't know if that name means anything to you. He's been involved in the music industry in Nashville. He sponsors the Creation Festival. It's this week. So on Friday or Saturday night, I'm going to be with 120,000 people, but I will be up on the stage with my wife listening to contemporary Christian music. It's really loud. It's really loud. But I remember last year, there came a point when there was a singer by the name of Toby Mac. And it's like Christian rap almost. But there were 100,000 people. He managed to deflect attention from him. Under God with a particular music form, and 100,000 people lit candles at a certain point, and he started singing one song that was deeply moving. I still remember. So God, thank goodness for the grace of God, and God being able to use so many different ways of worshiping, that we have to be careful. If I was up there listening to these folks sing, and I started thinking about Jim Morrison, I think, what do we got going on here? Somehow we've crossed the line, maybe.
I have a brief that maybe it's not necessarily the music or the decibel level, but as you can set, whose story is being told? Because as we enter into a community, the anthropologist would tell us, we start to revalue, you know, what's going on, and that's how life transformation takes place. I'm not negating the idea of a sacramental moment where God himself is there, but I think that's the key, is that whose story? Is it my story, our story, or is it the story of the God who came?
Let's try this one.
Whoops.
That would not be helpful.
That's very quiet.
It's very quiet.
Very quiet still. And he was silent for a little and poured water into a cup. This particular saying occurs in different forms in this literature. So in this one, he was silent for a little, poured water into a cup, and he said, look at the water. And it was cloudy. After a little, he said again, now look, see how clear the water has become. So you have, in this saying, you have water that becomes still. The sediment falls, I guess, to the bottom of the glass, or the bucket. And then, it's interesting, we move from the water to the people who were looking at the water. And when they leaned over the water, they saw their faces as in a glass, like a mirror. And then he said to them, so it is with the man who lives among men. He does not see his own sins because of the turmoil. But when he's at rest, especially in the desert, then he sees his sin. So there's two, can you see the two dynamics in the story? One has to do with simply, well, water settling, sediment settling, the pace at which someone is living, that broader environment, which is preventing her from seeing clearly. There's a settling that takes place, and then when the clarity comes, you're seeing yourself. And in this movement from self-deception to self-awareness, there you have the mirror. But the mirror was formed by slowing down and being quiet. And then having the courage to take a good look. When he's at rest, especially in the desert, then he sees his own sins. And I'd say, having read the literature, yes, some of the time. Not always, but it can help. So the question I'll have for myself is, all right, I'm working in, you know, Philadelphia. How can I create that kind of environment where that kind of clarity can come? In Skeet, now Skeet's located in what's known as Lower Egypt, which means more towards the Mediterranean. And there were well-known Abbas there. And Skeet, the brother went to Abba Moses to ask for a word. And let me talk just a word or two about Abba Moses. Abba Moses was, sometimes he's called Moses the Ethiopian. Sometimes he's called Moses the African. He might have been as tall as I am, which would have been highly unusual in the ancient world. Most Roman soldiers were about 5 feet 6 inches tall. People just weren't as tall as we are. And he was tall, African background, and in his pre-Christian days was an extremely violent man. He had committed murder, and he'd robbed people. And then he's touched by the Spirit of God in the end of his life. He was actually one of the martyrs of the church. At the end of his life, he's an extremely wise man with a lot of history that Christ has redeemed. This is one of the most well-known sayings. Sometimes these sayings are called apothegmata. If you run across that weird word that I just spit out at you, it just means saying. So,
So a brother goes to Abba Moses to ask a word. The given is that Abba Moses has been in prayer. He's been himself quiet. He's been sitting perhaps in his cell with different breaks during the day, maybe manual labor. By this time, he's watching over monastic community. Now, in a lot of these things, an older man is there, an Abba, perhaps an older woman. So here, someone comes to him and asks for a word. Just a word. And I can see Abba Moses is probably just sitting there and he looks at somebody. And he's praying for discernment, or what they call discretion. And he says to this particular person, go sit in your cell and we'll tell you everything you need to know. That's good, but can we think of something else? That sounds boring. I'm just going to be me and God in the walls of a cave or a cell. And he probably would have just been insisting, no. That's a very well-known saying, which in that line, go to yourself and yourself will teach you everything you need to know, is a saying that almost all of these folks were aware of. So the question would be, I've got to ask him. Yeah, because, we're in our church at home, and we're looking at a congregation, and we know that there's truth in that statement. So help me here. How would we communicate that truth to them in a way that they could receive and perhaps be changed? You have some ideas at that point? How would we communicate that to someone?
You could model it and give testimony to your experience.
So we might have our own experience of moving into that regimen of sorts. Anything else come to mind?
I think fasting and prayer.
Yeah, but I'm thinking specifically just of a cell. I'm not thinking of fasting now or prayer, but just space itself. How do Americans, for example, we're in Florida, I was in Canada last week. How do Americans think about space? Yeah.
Change the term cell to prayer closet.
Prayer closet. Huh.
I think we have to intentionally, I know this doesn't quite get to it, but at least let's start heading in that direction in our corporate worship experience by intentionally designing worship that has periods of quiet and silence. That's really heretical and revolutionary.
So a corporate design
set. At least start there.
3 minutes?
Well, at our own church, it was either Trinity Sunday or Transfiguration, I can't recall, but I think Trinity Sunday. And I believe it was. And we were teaching through the famous Rublev icon of the Trinity. And we sat in silence for 30 minutes or something like that. And it was extremely instructive, not the least of which to me, because I'm a flibbertigibbet who can't be still. And I think if we really do believe that the way that we worship shapes the way we believe, then we should at least start modeling some of that in corporate worship.
Sure. I'm thinking of two things. In the Liturgy of the Hours and the Roman Catholic Missal, there is a time of sacred silence that's programmed and is skipped at most parishes, and it shouldn't be. But I think this is a good place to start, and I think it always has been a part of the church, but it's something that's it's glossed over. And secondly, I'm thinking of liturgies that are designed for sacred silence, like Teze Liturgy, where we have two or three times of 10 to 15 or 20 minutes of silence and either reflecting on the scripture passage that was just read or the icons in the worship space. These types of liturgies can be very powerful too. Liturgies that are designed for the purpose of silent meditation.
So it's a good principle. It sounds like we're starting with small steps. 5 minutes, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, rather than an entire day or a week or...
In our Catholic service,
priest always finishes the homily, and he goes and he sits, and there's total silence. Well, I don't know how long. Everybody doesn't say a word or move around or anything. And also, at another point in the service, he sits. Nobody moves.
And what's interesting in the examples we've talked about, we're talking about something that's corporate, communal, we're with other people. This is a step beyond that. This is somebody who's going to be left to themselves in a learning space by themselves with periodic contact. But the hours can go on for a long time and the days can go on for a long time. We'll have to talk about that a little bit. Yeah.
I think also of what takes place in traditional Eastern Orthodox settings for lay people who are called to be semi-monastic, they actually go to hermitages and program this into their yearly cycle, as well as Franciscans. Franciscans have a long tradition of being very active in the world, yet retreating to a place of quiet, prayer, and reflection, and then going back into the world and then kind of going back and forth.
Yeah, that's a good rhythm. A couple of examples from my own life. There's a Norbertine Abbey near where we live of white monks. They wear the white robes and so on. And they have a hermitage. And I've only done it once, but I still remember the experience and some of the dynamics of that experience, which turned out to be good, but at the beginning, I just did it all. Man, I'm bored. I just do almost anything than be here. Secondly, I've worked a little bit in passing the Curcio movement. And I remember in Geneva, we would work with folks in World Health Organization, United Nations, Caterpillar Corporation. Folks are so busy. So busy. And they would go on retreat on a Friday evening, and I would stand by the door and had a box, a little box. And as they walked in, these execs, for the most part, I'd say, can I have your wristwatch? They would rather I have ripped their throat out or their heart out than give me that wristwatch. So we took away time in terms of, we'll take care of time for you for the next 48 hours. And then what we asked was, we're going to give a gift to one another till lunch tomorrow, and that is the gift of silence. And by the time that Sunday evening came, it was so remarkable as well. They had encountered God in some way. And there would be a Eucharist service and so on, and they're crying. These are execs who probably haven't cried in 40 years. So there's something about space, time, and so on that I think they're getting at. Yeah.
I've seen so many times that, you know, we have so many hymns that speak of solitude. Silence, be still and know that I am God. Go to the garden alone, be still for the presence of the Lord. And many people, they come to the church and sing these texts, but they don't incorporate them at all. And, you know, if we're going to say, be still and know that I am God, then we should be doing that in service. Because we should be living what we preach with those texts. And I really... silence and worship. Silence is just so potent, so powerful. And I really wish that many more congregations had, you know, come from a musical standpoint. I love my prelims, I love my postludes, but what I'm very keen on, you know, the hour from, like 5 or 10 minutes of prayer before the service begins to get that reverent state of mind instead of, you know, pre-service music and all that. So
I'd like to comment that in terms of this integration of life, our culture is hungry for permission to live in this way. And there is a constant interruption from texting. My 17-year-old son here can vouch for that. And they may be hungry, may create some disconcerting moments to incorporate large periods of silence in corporate worship, But as we integrate this into all of life, this lady's comment on fasting and a certain fasting of technology, a certain fasting of communication, would be so welcomed in our families. And I think of the healing that can come as families listen together, as individuals go into that prayer closet, wherever that is. So I think we need to expand our understanding beyond that corporate hour and time. You know, you said earlier, talking about the previous slide about the corporate flesh, and there was also this quote of, I don't know, moving in a crowd. I can't remember what the quote was. I'm looking here. But I think that's so true, you know, that we need that space, and we need that aloneness, all knowing that we are truly there for us. So.
Yeah, that's good, because we had been talking about corporate silence. This is something different. This is a step in kind of a frightening way in some ways. I want to talk about something I plan on talking about tomorrow, but I'm not.
I have one experience. They took us all on cellular phone. That is frightening. Our mobile phone. Everybody's mobile phone. No mobile phone. No way. But that was corporate. By time.
Yeah. Here's what I did to my students. I was walking into class in the auditorium at 8:30 in the morning. 6 weeks into the semester done, 7 weeks to go. This is about 2 years ago. And they're all semi-comatose. Just waking up. And so I was walking down the highway, and I had read a study by a philosopher in Canada that talked about media fasts. They talked about some of the effects of media fasts. Students' sleep patterns become more normalized. Their anxiety level drops. They lose weight. Their GPA goes up. All kinds of interesting things. So I walked down in the front of the class. We have 7 weeks to go. And I said, I'll tell you what I'll do. I said, good morning, I'll tell you what I'll do. At the end of the class, your final grade, if it's an 85, I will raise it to a 90. I'll give you a 5% increase if you just do something for me. And suddenly, you could hear bodies moving and people waking up and so on. And here's what I'm going to ask you to do. For the next 7 weeks, and then literally off the top of my head, I just started saying, no, no, no. So I said, all right, for the next 7 weeks, 5 minutes a day, cell phone use, max. No music. No internet. No Twitter. No Facebook. No, and I just kept, no, 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 no emailing. Nada, 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 nada. And then, oh, Dr. Holland says, oh, you can't be serious, oh. Tony Campolo's granddaughter is sitting back up here, and she said, Dr. Howell, how will I know who my friends are? How will I talk to my friends? And I said, well, probably the way that human beings have talked to each other for 1,000 years. You find them and talk to them. There was somebody sitting right where Mark is sitting, and she said, Dr. Hall, what about praise music? No. Another said, right about where Chris is, well, on Easter, there's one song I always love to listen to. No. I just said no to everything. Everything possible I could say no to. And then I said for 7 weeks. And I thought out of a class of 220 students that year, I might get 4 or 5. And I had 41 who took me up on that. And I would have had 37 told the truth. And they said, and we've continued that at Easter. So now people who take this course know that sooner or later that media fast is going to kick in. And if you want that 5% increase, you're going to move into a world that's so different from anything you've ever experienced in your life. Friday evenings, most students watch film, go to a movie, turn music on, listen to CDs, go on the net, none of it. Get in the car to drive from point A to point B, the radio doesn't come on.
There was an article in the paper, the school paper about this and so on and so forth. And then they journal about their experience. And generally speaking, what they'll say is, I was anxious for the first week or two. Because I didn't know what to do. The world was so different. It was so quiet. Anxious. I lost, for some of them, a sense of control over my environment. All the things that I had come to rely on, some will say, in terms of my support structure, my entertainment level. This is God. And then, generally speaking, if they make it through to the end, they'll say something like, well, I think I'm going to take parts of that experience into my future, but I'm not going to go on that media fast again. But they do want to incorporate something into their experience because they experienced something good as a result of that regimen. But it's like asking somebody to run a marathon. We'll get back to that idea sometime tomorrow. Now, patience or fortitude is a new topic. And I'll just gaze at that for a minute. There's different ways that we can think about patience. So in these sayings, it's a kind of patience that has to do with hanging in there. Kind of patience that has to do with not running when you want to run. Not hiding when you want to hide. I really like Abba Agatho. I think you would like to have dinner with him. He tends to be a gentle soul. But he can be very direct. So this is a sweet brother. And he goes to Abba Agatho. Now watch the dynamic. Abba Agatho, and he says to him, Abba, I've been instructed to go somewhere. And I have a grievous struggle in the place where I've been told to go. That's the problem. So there's someone that he is called to obedience to, and he's been instructed to go somewhere, and he does not want to do what he's been asked to do. And is experiencing deep conflict. And on the one hand, he says, I want to obey the order, yet I'm frightened of the inner struggle that will ensue, because I don't want to do what I'm being asked to do. It's going to hurt. It's going to demand something of me. And so Agatho responds somewhat obliquely. He doesn't scold him. Doesn't yell at him. But he refers to himself in the third person and says, Agatho was like that. He obeyed orders and so won the battle. In other words, what you're experiencing is not foreign to me. I have the same kinds of struggles with this idea of obedience. And I hung in there. And something good was the result. Now, so ask to bring us, we're going to take a break in 5 minutes. But ask yourself the question, where has Christ asked something of you like that? Man, you want to run. You want to run. And everything within us says, I just know if I could go somewhere else, this would be resolved. I could just get to a different place with a different community of people or a different person in authority over me. And authority relationships could be really wild and crazy and dangerous. If I could just do something else to get out of this struggle. And this Abba says, yeah, I understand. I was like that too. Hang in there. And they work on that idea because you get out in the desert or you join a monastic community, but think about it in the desert, and for the first, maybe the first day or two, first week, first month, it's kind of cool. People are thinking of me as a spiritual athlete. And I'm growing, I'm getting to hang out with these great Abbas of the church, whatever. But sooner or later, something kicks in, and you start thinking, I'm sick of this. In fact, I think we're going to get into that. Just a minute. Let's try one more. Yeah, now this relates to the idea of patience and fortitude. The danger of the desert is the danger of kind of a spiritual heroics. I'm going to become like Abba Anthony the Great. If he fasted for 2 weeks on end, I'll fast for 3 weeks. If that monk's praying 80 psalms a day, I'll pray 90 and keep track with the stones in my mouth. Abba Joseph asked Abba Pullman. Abba Pullman is another one I think you'd like. How should we fast? What's interesting, this is on patience and fortitude. And Abba Pullman said, I would have everyone eat a little less than once every day. That catches Abba Joseph off guard. Doesn't sound like one. Wait a minute. We're supposed to be fasting here. Just a little bit less every day? He says, when you were a young man, didn't you fast for 2 days on end? And the old man said to him, believe me, I used to fast 3 days on end, even for a week. But the great elders have tested all these things, and they found that it's good to eat something every day, but on some days a little less.
Isn't that kind of sweet?
And they've shown us that this is the king's highway, for it's easy in life. Do you remember your question, Mayor? It's easy in life. So as the wisdom of the desert grew, they increasingly realized, if we're not careful, we'll break people out here. They'll snap. In fact, we'll see something from Abba Anthony to that way. We don't want people snapping, breaking. We want people growing deep. We want to help them develop fortitude. So what he seemed to be saying is small, consistent steps. Where, you know, I really like another piece of chocolate and just for cake. And he said, no, I don't think so. Probably not. Maybe we'll even skip it for tonight. I really like the second helping of nachos with cheese. Like we would eat together at lunch. And he might say, well, yeah. It was nice, but let's support a little bit. And in the manner of speaking, all adds up. So, we'll go back to patience and fortitude at 2:30, but I think I'm watching the group, and I think we just need to get up and get something to drink, stretch, whatever, and then we'll spend another hour with these folks, and then maybe we'll pick it up tomorrow. All right?